Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and welcome to Jazz on the Tube, the Jazz on the Tube podcast. And today we're going to be talking with somebody I've been wanting to interview for a long time. And this particular program is inspired by a remark made by Duke Ellington, where he said, "I don't want to be called a jazz musician." And I remember when I first heard that, young jazz fan, I thought, why doesn't he want to be called a jazz musician? And then as I became more mature, I realized jazz is a form, and it's a great form, but musicians want to do what musicians want to do, whatever that may be. And so I think what Duke Ellington was responding to was the idea that all he could be was a jazz musician and play in the jazz slot, which is a great slot to be in. But he saw himself, and in fact was, a musician. Which meant you can go in any sonic direction you want. So what I want to do every year from now on, starting on the solstice, which is when we're recording this, and we'll do it next year on the solstice with another artist, is someone who's known as a jazz musician and who has definite jazz chops, who has done something that is musical and not jazz. And we're going to talk about it. And I'm sort of inspired by these director's versions of DVDs, if you've ever seen them, where you know, the movie's playing and the director is talking about, you know, why I did this shot, why I did that shot. So I'm going to see how much behind the scenes we can extract from Aurora on that. But before we begin, Aurora, one of the many fascinating things about you is that you are a multi-generational musical artist. Could you just tell people a little bit about, because it sounds like one of your ancestors was one of the original generation of saxophone players, or if not the, you know, darn close to the original. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I actually don't know what you're referring to, as in one of my ancestors was one of the original saxophone.
Well, if you have a great-grandfather or a great-grandfather whose saxophone you have?
I have my father's saxophone. I don't believe it was his father's saxophone. And so, yeah, I have is my father's. My father had an old C melody saxophone that I inherited from him when he passed away.
Oh, okay. I'm reading something fanciful from somewhere then that talks about fifth generation musician and that somebody make this up.
Could be. Oh, but I want to read it. Now I'm curious.
I got to find it now. I just read it this getting ready for the call, and then I was trying to find it to ask you about it. Well, we'll edit this part out.
Okay. But I'm curious about that.
Yeah, because if somebody's great grandfather, because the saxophone's not that old an instrument. I mean, it's not totally.
Oh yeah, like the 1890s, it was invented by Adolf Sax, you know, and then so yeah, it's relatively new in terms of other instruments. I also don't know that I could name my great grandfather. I don't know. I mean, both my parents are musicians.
Okay.
And my grandmother played the organ, and my grandmother on the other side and grandfather played piano. So that's kind of as far back as I know.
Okay. I'll find this article and send it to you.
Yeah, now I'm curious.
They named poetically. Well, they named like specific people's names, and it's like he gave the saxophone to so-and-so, and then it ended up with his grandson, which was your father, and then he gave it to you, and it's like, wow, what a story, you know?
Wow. I'm very curious to read the story now. I'm not sure.
Well, I admire whoever wrote it. I admire them. They are a good storyteller. I'll tell you a true Adolf Sax saxophone story. So one day I was going to Philadelphia on the bus with Ornette Coleman's band to play at the Cool Jazz Festival. And so it was Ornette. It was Adolf Sax's birthday, and it was like there was a little item in the newspaper. So Ornette goes, "Oh, this is the guy that got me my job." I just thought that was so funny, you know.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. But you know,
it's true.
I always tell people it's like music's a job. I mean, it's many things. It's multidimensional, but there's definitely a dimension where it's a job, you know. And for Ornette, like he was helping his family pay the rent in a fatherless home by playing in these horrible gut bucket, you know, down by the river, bad side of town clubs. Anyway,
sure,
all right. So let's get back on track. Okay.
Okay.
So I'm going to edit out all that stuff.
I'm very curious now. I am. Like, tell me more about Ornette, but maybe for another time, I guess.
I'll tell you one story that is just fascinating. So the first gig he ever had out of town was in Amarillo, Texas, which is kind of nowhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really, and there was a nightclub, and so he was in the band, and he was young. He was really young, teenager. And there was a famous, like, I can't even call him a slide guitar player because he invented his own kind of guitar that has this really weird sound. And he was famous for all these sort of novelty songs, you know, real total hillbilly guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out, I learned from somebody else, I never learned this from Ornette, but I learned this from someone else later, much later, that young teenage Ornette Coleman, who'd never been out of the ghetto of Fort Worth in his life, is out in, you know, Amarillo, Texas, playing this weird nightclub gig for a couple of months. And this hillbilly, so the guy was an amazing musician, and he used to get together after hours and jam.
Wow. Well, that's amazing.
Wow. Yeah. Well, it makes sense because he has such a long, deep friendship with Charlie Hayden, who was from Missouri and grew up singing, you know, kind of grand old Opry kind of stuff as a two-year-old with the family choir.
God, that's amazing. I was meant to play with the Hayden triplets this year at Big Ears Festival, and of course it got canceled, but I was so excited. I'm such big fans of that family in general.
Oh, yeah. You know, that whole band, you know, Ornette's son, DiNardo, became a musician.
Uh-huh.
Don Cherry's daughter became a singer. Charlie Hayden's
kids became musicians.
Yeah. Of course, Dewey Redman's son is a famous jazz guy. I can't remember his name. I don't think he has the last name Redman. But he became...
Not Joshua Redman?
Joshua, yeah, Joshua. That's Joshua.
Yeah.
It is the same name.
Yeah.
Charles Moffett's son, Charnette. Everyone associated with that band has children that became pretty good professional musicians, you know. Okay, so let's
good music. Okay.
Well, can you imagine hanging out in your living room with Uncle Ornette, Uncle Don, and Mr. Blackwell?
Yeah, if you were around such powerful music, you know, I would think because you'd want to. You'd be interested, at least curious enough to do it as a kid.
Well, I think it'd break because my family's not musical doesn't have musical didn't play music at home. And I had traditional, horrifically bad piano teacher who traumatized me as a child.
Oh.
It's the way, it's my karma. So at 61, I'm starting to play piano. So I'm like, it's
amazing.
So amazing. Yeah, and it's like, did you ever see the movie The Miracle Worker with Patty Duke? It's about Helen Keller.
No.
Oh, there's this amazing scene. So Helen Keller's blind, she's deaf, she's dumb. I mean, she's like completely cut off from the world. And she had a companion caretaker. And one day she's pumping water, and then the caretaker wrote the letter W.
Right, I remember this story.
Right. And so it was like a total revelation, right? So when I learned that there's a thing called an interval, like there's a sixth, and like it's a consistent sound, and the sound that I've loved my whole life has a name, I almost died. I mean, I almost wept. Aww. I couldn't believe it, you know?
And then
I learned that, I wouldn't have it any other way. I'm actually totally happy it happened this way, because I'm sitting at the piano going like, whoa, 5-1. I've heard that. That is. I can't believe it. You know? All right, so.
What's amazing is that when you do know, it still is powerful. When you're like, even when you do sort of know the inner workings of something, when you genuinely hear like a movement from 1-4, you still like, that sounds great. I feel something.
Good to hear. That's good to hear that it makes sense. Like, I doubt, you know, there was ever a time when Van Gogh said, oh, blue again. Oh man,
right.
Really?
Right.
Enough with the blue already. Interesting. Now, well, while we're on this riff, you are also an educator. Well, first of all, I've seen you in clubs with little kids on your lap showing them how your soprano saxophone works. So you have educational impulse, and you've also taught at some camps, I think, right? Is that right?
Yeah, I've taught mostly at the Walden School for Young Musicians, which is a really fabulous program that's run up in New Hampshire in the summertime. It's based out of San Francisco, but the school part is run in New Hampshire for the summertime, and its focus is really on fostering creative musicians. So it's really not geared towards performance. It's geared towards composition.
Oh, really?
It's one of the finest programs I know for young composers because it really teaches a very holistic approach to discovery of sound and organizing sound and time, which is then becomes composition. And so I've taught at the Walden School for 5 or 6 years, teaching computer musicianship and composition. And then for the last 15 years, I've been associated with them ever since I first started teaching there, which I was 22, I think, when I first started teaching there. And now I go back as a guest artist. They have a really fabulous concert series that they put on where they bring, I think, about 6 different professional ensembles throughout the summer to give concerts. And then the last 2 weeks, they bring a professional chamber ensemble up from New York they're reading and workshopping the students' pieces. So that's the most experience I've had sort of teaching. And then I've done a lot of facilitating for older musicians who are more along the lines of my peers, and that's through an organization called Found Sound Nation that we host residencies for international musicians that brings together anywhere between 10 and 15, well, 10 and 25, depending on the program, different musicians from like 15 different countries. And we bring them together and then kind of facilitate music and cultural programming and outreach programming. So I've done a little bit of teaching younger folks and then a lot of sort of facilitating and organizing of older folks.
I think I saw one of those foundation shows at Snug Harbor there were a bunch of musicians from the subcontinent, India and Pakistan.
So yeah, that's right. That project was called the Dosti Project, and that was exactly as you said. It was 6 musicians from India, 4 musicians from Pakistan, and then we had 3 featured musicians from the U.S. So it was sort of all about
incredible.
Thank you. Yeah, it was great to sort of bring that project to New Orleans. As part of the core piece of that residency, we were here in New Orleans for 2 weeks, and then it was traveling for another 2 weeks.
I remember I was walking down Royal, or one of those streets, I don't have the directions ever, but Marigny, or might have even been Bywater East, or whatever, and uh-huh. I walked by a house, and there was a guy just wailing away on the tablas, and I thought, oh, that's a great thing to be hearing in New Orleans. You know, he was practicing or showing somebody something, and he must have been part of that group. Last question about Walden. What's the age group for that program?
That's generally 11 to 18 or to however old you are after your last year of high school-ish. So, generally 10 to 18.
Got it. Well, the first time I heard Aurora play was, I think it was 2006, and it was the fall. And I was in New Orleans trying to figure out how to be helpful, and I was kind of discouraged because it was really hard to get a handle on things at that time. And I spent a couple of days just wandering around and talking to different people. And so I didn't know about Frenchman Street then. I didn't realize how much music was in New Orleans. I know that's absurd, but I just didn't realize. And I stumbled on Frenchman Street. And I was like, oh, my God, this is incredible, you know. And then I walked into the Spotted Cat, and there was Va Va Voom, and you guys were wailing away, and it was phenomenal. And, so I heard, and I actually had a little camera. They don't make them anymore, but it was like this one-use video camera came and went, but I had it for that year. And you were playing the soprano, and it was just a perfect – it was a composition. Solo was a composition. I loved it. It's fantastic. Did I ever send it to you? Do you know the one I'm talking about?
No, I don't. I don't see many videos from that era, which is both a blessing and a curse.
no curse on this one. No curse on this one. And I think it's the first video of you on YouTube of any video ever, because it goes back to 2006. So I'll have to make sure you a link.
Okay,
but I remember sitting there going, is she as good as I think she is, or am I just in having some sort of subjective experience? You know, you never know.
You're in the New Orleans spell. Yeah.
Right. You know? So, but then I said, you know what? I think she is. I'm just going to go out on a limb. And then I was really pleased to see that a few years later, you were voted best saxophonist of New Orleans.
Yeah.
A couple of times. So, of course, you know, I think musicians are embarrassed by things like that because there's, you know, it's like, how can I say, you know. On the other hand, it does let people know that, hey, this cat can play, right? We just, you know, that. So for people listening to this, if jazz is your thing, the Royal Roses, is that the name of it, right? The Royal Roses?
Yeah, the Royal Roses.
Royal Roses. I'll put some links below. You will get all the jazz you can handle. I love your band. I love the way it works
Thank
together.
You.
You got some amazing people on it. There was one guy I remember. I guess he sometimes played in or was a visitor at the Saturday Night Live band. Does that ring a bell?
Oh, maybe the trombonist.
I can't remember what instrument he was playing, but I remember you announced that and. He did a solo that just almost blew me out the door. It was so incredible. So it's a really good band. It's a really good band. But now and then there's other groups that you've been involved with, like this group that I can't believe I've never heard it, but the Rory Danger and the Danger Dangers.
That is a group here in New Orleans. Yeah.
Yeah, and they are great. you know of them.
You would love them.
I guess. Okay, and then there's a group called Why Are We Building Such a Big Ship?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, my friend Walter McClements, a really fine songwriter and accordionist, and was one of the first bands I played in moving here. Actually, one of the first bands that I think we all formed together, and so it was a really great band of friends. Some of whom knew how to play their instruments, and sometimes the rehearsals would go that Walter or I would write a song, and then we'd be teaching the song, as in saying, like, okay, this part goes, okay, valves one and two, valves one and three, valve one, but up a partial, no, up another one, okay, that, you know. And so it was a really great group. Walter writes just extremely beautiful music, and that band hasn't been around. Gosh, I think Walter is in LA now. So I think that band hasn't been around maybe for even 9 years. But Walt has a really fabulous project called Lonesome Leash, which is his solo project. And he's just, like I said, an extraordinarily beautiful songwriter.
Oh, great.
And why are we building such a big ship? We have some old albums that are floating around somewhere, mostly on vinyl, that you could probably get through Domino Sound Record Shop if one really wanted to. They kind of feel like vintage pieces of a certain era of New Orleans. Like, we did a lot of kind of DIY shows or punk shows put on by Brian Funk in, you know, in a lot of, I don't know, yards and abandoned houses and outdoor spaces. And so that band has a very special place in my heart, for sure.
Well, the years after the flood, the levee failure flood that they call Katrina, were clearly very difficult, but it was kind of a golden age too, in another way, creatively and musically. There were so many incredible things going on. And then you also played with a band called Panorama Jazz Band. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's correct.
And that's another great band.
Yeah, that's a great band. I still play in that band. That was one of the first bands I joined in New Orleans. I used to see them when I first moved to town in 2004. I would go and see them a lot. That's led by Ben Schenk, clarinetist, and the repertoire is a really beautiful repertoire. It's all acoustic, and it's all the same instrumentation, but it's a mixture of Afro-Caribbean, which of course is music that has a very deep-rooted place associated with New Orleans music, so it's a mixture of Afro-Caribbean music and then Balkan music and klezmer music. So
yeah.
It plays repertoire that's kind of from various different parts of the world that fit with this same instrumentation.
And I still play with that band today. Oh, that's great. And I can testify that is another band you must check out if you're in New Orleans and you see they're playing, just drop everything and go. It's really good. I have something maybe from 2007 at the French Quarter Festival with you guys playing. And I caught you all at a good moment. So I'll send you that link too. I'll put all these links that I'm talking about on this page for everybody that you can check them out. All right, so now we're going to get to the main event, which is this somewhat mysterious album to me. I mean, I've listened to it a lot, so the music's not totally mysterious, but its origins and its meaning and who's the monocle and what's kind humankind and all that kind of thing. So this is an album that came out in 2016?
Sure.
Something like that.
I think it actually has never been released still, but has sort of been on a very slow leak for years and years and years. And yeah, 2016 sounds right.
That was when the leak started.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, let's Let's hope the leak will eventually turn into a torrent, because I love this album, and I was telling Aurora earlier in another conversation that I cannot listen to this album and drive a car and operate a vehicle, because I will go. I mean, I'm not even exaggerating. I just get too interested in what's going on, and so I only listen to it when I'm home behind closed doors and in a safe space.
A driving hazard on it, huh?
Yeah, it's really weird. You know, they do say, like, do not operate machinery, you know, on certain medications.
Right.
So this album actually is, and I don't know another album that does that to me. I'm not sure why it does it to me, but let's talk about some of the surface stuff on this. So number one, you play all the instruments.
Yes. Yeah. It's a solo album in the true sense of the word, in that it's music written by me and that's played by many, many overdubbed versions of myself.
So not to strain your memory, I'm going to read the album of what all the instruments you play: accordion, drums, guitar, piano, organ, saxophones, plural. And I know you play alto and soprano. Did you play any other saxophones on this one? Do you remember?
I don't think so. I think.
And then
there's not
flute.
Yeah.
And then flute, trumpet, and percussion. No violin.
No violin. No. No one needs to hear me play the violin. Although I enjoy it, but no one else needs to suffer through that.
So for people that, like me included, can't imagine how one does this, mechanically, what do? Like lay down like one track and then you go back and play over that one and then go back and play over the next one, you know, just keep stacking it up?
I mean, when you're doing a solo, you know, there's great advantages to teaching people music and composing your music and teaching it to people that you want to play it, or oftentimes even better, giving parts to people and then they improve upon it or they play idiomatically very differently than you could play yourself on it. And with this album, I was really sort of interested in my own limitations and interested in just sort of trying to explore what I would sound like if I took everything that was out of my head and put it into my hands and played it. And so, yeah, it's a quite a tedious process a little bit, and each song is a little bit different. But, yeah, you just lay down track of whatever the bass instrument is at the time. For a lot of this album, it's accordion. And then you go back and start overdubbing and layering. And it's a lot like painting, I think of it. You know, it's orchestrating. The recording process is so wonderful in that you can really kind of paint and immediately hear back.
Mm-hmm.
If I could actually be paid to do anything, I would just get paid to just record all day and be in the studio recording, I would jump at that opportunity at a hat. That would be so wonderful, because I really enjoy myself in the studio working with a great engineer.
Wow. Okay. And even working solo the way you made this album, even working that way.
Yeah. I mean, I worked with a really fabulous engineer, my friend Don Godwin, who I've known for a long time. You know, so a lot of it I had pre-planned, but then there were parts of it in the studio where I'd be like, "Oh, Don, I want to try one more harmony part, a little different," you know, and I'd be like, "Okay, let's do one more vocal track," and then I would look over and I'd be like, "Don, I think I want to try a backbeat with these metal stairs that I see in the corner over here. Can you mic these stairs?" You know, And then sometimes Don would throw ideas of like, why don't we reamp the accordion, and we're going to put the amp in another room. We're going to like distort it greatly, and then I'll mic that amp, and then I'll bring it back into the recording. So, you know, there's an amazing thing that happens when you work with a fabulous engineer who really is excited about sound, is as excited about sound as you are.
Well, that kind of speaks to the theme of this program that I hope to do every year, which is it's sound. It's about sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a sound art, which means any sounds you can conceive, not limited to whatever is in the classic toolkit. You know, whatever, you know, if you want to bang on a metal stairway, that may create the sound you want for the effect that you want to create.
Right.
Yes, it's interesting. So people that don't know, I would say you're a pretty social person, and certainly when you're fronting your band, it's a really great social event for people that go out and hear the band. So it's surprising that, you know, if you were to rank musical operations, that working in the studio is the most interesting to you. But I can see why based on what you're saying, because it's like a painter in the studio. It's
yeah,
perfect.
I love it.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of, you were talking about laying down the bass, and that very often the bass for your performances on this album is the accordion. You clearly love the accordion. Can you talk a little bit about your feelings for the accordion?
feelings.
Well, you know what I mean? You definitely love this instrument. There's no two ways around it, right?
Yeah, it's a beautiful. I mean, I think any accordion player might be able to test that your feelings for the accordion are quite complicated, because it itself is a very temperamental instrument, especially in this day and age when you can really dial in so much with like MIDI and with direct input. And but the accordion is also a really beautiful instrument. It's essentially like a little organ in a box, or it's a little orchestra in a box. And the reason that so much of that initial album is accordion-based is because I used to play the songs live, where I would play accordion, sometimes through effects pedals, but sometimes just the accordion, and then I would do these kind of foot drum things with it. And that was the original monocle, was just a really stripped-down, kind of bare-bones version of a lot of these songs.
Got it.
I'm not an extremely fine accordion player, I would tell people. I rarely would get hired, for instance, to play an idiomatic musical gig on the accordion, like a Balkan gig or a klezmer gig or a zydeco gig. I will get hired to play the music of Aurora Nealand, and I will be the person hiring myself. Or I often play the accordion in a lot of like open improvisation or free improvisation contexts. But I love the accordion just that it's, you know, it's an instrument that breathes, it's a chordal instrument that breathes, which is kind of two loves of mine. And that is, mm-hmm. it's a harmonic instrument, and it also is an instrument with breath. And
I guess
there's
from
something
a practical
about it that's
point,
very, very attractive to me.
Yeah, I guess also from a practical point of view is you can rest your chops, right? You don't have to be, you don't have to create the air for that air sound.
Yeah,
you get a mechanical help from the box.
That's true. I mean, also you can't sing when there's a horn in your mouth. So I think that is one of the largest.
I never thought of that. See, I'm learning a lot. I'm learning a lot about music. Okay, so, and I also want to tell people, at some point in time, Aurora did some covers of Tom Waits on, I think you were on accordion, and wow. I hope.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's ever had the chance to hear your work on.
Oh, I doubt it. No, he has millions of people doing covers of his songs. You know.
I know, but you can hold your ears, because I don't want to embarrass you. Roars are like amazing. I think if he heard them, it would have an impact on him, because you really bring stuff
thank
out.
You.
Yeah, no, you really do. You really do.
Yeah, the lyrics to a lot of his songs are very beautiful. You know, and he actually, from my understanding, his partner Kathleen Brennan also writes a lot of the lyrics to many of those songs, that those later songs that we know and love. And so I think a lot of Tom Waits' lyrics and just emotiveness that he has they're great. They're still great. Even, you know, I haven't listened to him in quite a long time. I think many of us have, like, you go through phases where you really listen to something. And I know for me, Tom Waits, I listened to when I was 13, between like 13 and 20.
Uh-huh.
And I love those soundscapes of those later albums and the lyrical content. And it still holds true, you know, decades later.
That leads us to this, which is one of the things that Waits has is, in addition to a musical presence, there's a theatrical presence. And that's one of the things for me going on with, is the name of the album, this is how ignorant I am, is the name of the album Kind Humankind?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so that's the name of the album. And then the monocle is the name of the artist?
Yeah, monocle is the name of the project or the artist, yeah.
Got it. So Kind Humankind, to me, is extremely theatrical. It kind of lights up the same, this is a weird neurological analogy, but it kind of lights up the same neurons that get lit up when I listen to opera. At least for me. So let's get, oh my God, it's the best. It's the best. You know, before movies, before television, before record players, we had opera, you know, and we still haven't surpassed it, in my opinion. But no, it's quite amazing. You know, it's kind of amazing thing. So this to me has that thing that's, it's musical, obviously, but it's also operating on these other dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
It's to me, I don't hear this as, oh, well, I have this song and hey, this is a pretty good song and gee, I'll put this one here. I mean, maybe that's how this was put together, but for some reason I hear kind of stories in every single song, and there is some kind of unity. I can't necessarily articulate what it is because I don't think it's spelled out, but I feel it's more like, I don't know, there's an album that Lou Reed did. I don't know if you ever heard it, called Berlin. Did you ever hear that album?
I can't say.
It's kind of obscure, and I don't think any of the songs were ever hits, mm-hmm. but every one of the songs was related to every other one of the other songs. I guess that's the thing that you know what I mean? It wasn't, hey, I've got 12 good ones. It was like, every one of these songs has a connection to every one of the other songs on the, you know?
Right, yeah.
So am I hearing that correctly, or am I experiencing a sonic delusion?
Oh, I mean, with the monocle, I really like to think of it as, it's kind of like my little birdcage project, as in there's like a little bird that lives inside your heart, and once in a while you like open it up and you let it out and you let it say some things, and then it gets scared of the world and so it goes back in. And I would say that all of those songs are coming from that same place.
Gotcha.
In my experience, you know, no one project can be your everything project, and so for me specifically, I like to have a few different musical projects because I'm really just trying to serve the music of that particular creature that is saying something in that project, you know. So I would say that there is certainly a continuity of sort of the lens of the monocle is, you know, has a continuity which I think runs through a lot of those songs. It has a more kind of vulnerable and sensitive lens of the world, and that kind of shapes the space of the songs, the space that those songs live.
Gotcha. That must be what I'm feeling when I'm hearing it. The monocle. What are we talking about when we're talking about a monocle? I know in the dictionary it's like a lens that you put on one eye to see better. Is there any meaning beyond that?
I think for me it's kind of, as I was saying, when I first started the project, it was just my little solo project. You know, I was doing a lot of things in the sideman in different bands or as a frontman, and I really was wanting just a project that was just about, like, for better or for worse, we really can only see the world as we see it through our little personal lenses. And of course, we have many tools to step outside and try to understand other perspectives. And, you know, there's a lot that can, you can experience other things, but I think ultimately that there is a piece of it that's like you're able to experience the world as you. And so the monocle kind of came from this thinking of like, oh, you got this one lens, or even like you're filtering the music through this one lens for this particular project. So it kind of came from that. And it was a solo project in the beginning.
Gotcha. I guess mono in the word mono is the word one too. So
yeah.
So it starts with kind of almost like a gong sound, the origins, and that sound kind of, I hear it again throughout different pieces. It reminds me of a sound I heard when I was a kid. I had this job where I had to fill a humidifier with water. And so I had to fill a tea kettle and walk across the room and, you know, pour it into this humidifier. And when I would hit the tea kettle against something, it would create a certain sound that I loved, right? And for some reason, the gong, I don't know, is it a gong? It's a bell? It's what is it?
It's an actual bell.
Oh, wow.
It's quite large, quite big. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. One of the things about the album for people, when you hear it, when you get it, which I recommend everybody do, the melodies are so, so wonderful. And it's kind of hard to objectify that or say anything more than that. But the melodies are very strong. Let's start with the first tune on it, first composition. And I heard pieces of this album, I guess on YouTube, I must have pieces, you know, here and there. And I always liked it. I always thought the melodies were strong. But it wasn't till later that I just sat down and started really listening to it and just listening to it through and through and through. But the first piece definitely I heard was Shall Not Want. It almost has a, I love that line, I shall not want. this feeling to disappear. Yeah, I don't know. By the way, the other thing I want to say for people, I discovered that Aurora is quite a poet, which you'll find out if you can get your hands on the lyrics. And I'm in the process of encouraging her to someday make a PDF.
Ken's lobbying.
I'm lobbying on behalf of a fan. Because I have to say, I always like the music, but once I got the lyrics and was able to, the libretto, really, to me, once I had the libretto and was able to follow the lyrics, really read them, it's like, oh, okay, all right, this is really even more than I already thought. So there's a great line in here, I will not fight, though madmen taught my heart to be a fist. I don't know, I'm kind of fishing here. What's this song about?
this
is a lame question.
Well,
but
there's always two answers when anyone asks you what a song is about, and the truthful answer is it's about whatever you hear it being about. That's the best answer. I know for me personally, it's coming from a very particular story and a very particular, like I fell in love, or actually we both of us fell in love. A man and I fell in love over one night at a festival, and he was engaged to be married like 10 months later. And we never had any physical relationship, but we had like a musical exchange for many months. And before he was about to get married, he asked me if he should break off his marriage. And I said, no. And so the song is sort of about wanting to hold on to those feelings of just joyously being able to see someone at their best and appreciating them for who they are, and wanting to like hold on to those feelings while also not letting them get warped by the realities of time, of meeting someone at the wrong time or not at the right time, or just appreciating that time for what it was. That you got to share with them, and those feelings you got to share with them. That's what it's about for me, but it's certainly meant to be, there's a lot of other stories in it. It's been a long time since I listened to the album, The Heart to Be a Fist, Though Madmen Taught My Heart to Be a Fist, is for me like a reference to punk culture and as a reference to my older brothers and to sort of punk culture, which in a lot of punk culture, there has been this saying that has gone around since I had kind of been going to punk houses and commune houses, which is your heart is the size of a fist. Keep loving, keep fighting. And so it's kind of coming from that world.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Or your heart is a muscle that your heart is a muscle, the size of a fist. Keep loving, keep fighting.
Gotcha. So, well, yeah, and maybe if when I put this together, I might just play this right now so people can hear it so they know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And if I may, and I'm going to say that it doesn't surprise me that there's something that poignant behind this song, because when everybody hears it, you'll know why. What I like is you know how it opens, and then you go into this later in the song, you go into this incredible jubilant movement, right? Could I tell you all the things that time has let forget? People will hear it when they hear it, and you'll see what I mean.
Yeah.
So it's got these two dimensions. Let's see what else, because we could talk forever. Now, Whistleblower, which you dedicated to, and I know this fellow, actually, and I'm drawing a blank on his name, one of the great NSA whistleblowers. At least somewhere I read that you dedicated it to him. It could be another false information that I got from some unreliable source. But let's talk about that. That's fascinating. And the rhythms that you put in this thing. Also, there's really interesting chorus or choral stuff that you did. So the words just starting out, hey, whistleblower, got the world on your shoulders. Got the weight of the world on your shoulders. Secrets, we're all getting older. Hold it, accidental soldier. What was in your mind putting this one together lyrically?
Whistleblower came out after I was really lucky to be at this conference, to be hired at a small conference that I won't make the name because it's a closed conference, but it was an incredible conference where there's this man who basically brings together about 25 people who are very high up in sort of internet and communication culture worldwide, and he brings them, he's this older scientist, and he brings them together once a year to sort of talk about what's happening and what are we going to talk about in this conference? What do we need to talk about? So it was at that conference at that time, there was a man that was making a documentary about Bill Binney, who was the whistleblower kind of before Edward Snowden, and I say whistleblower. And, you know, there were other pretty high up. There was a person that was working for Chelsea Manning at the time that was communicating with Chelsea Manning while they were imprisoned, and worked for a group called Fight for the Future, which is dealing with like communication and speech. And they're from Cox, the internet provider, and people that were really high up in Google and internet culture. So I got to be on the wall. And again, none of that was sort of making business connections, but just sort of talking about like, what are the ethical issues that we can foresee coming up, and what are ways that we can sort of talk to each other and talk about how we can ethically work as the architects of this ever progressing technology. So Whistleblower came after sort of having a long conversation with this documentarian who's making a film about Bill Binney, and just sort of, you know, thinking about the secrets that, you know, surveillance that we don't know about is hanging, and yeah, lots of other things. But that was the main impetus for that piece. And
gotcha.
Say like a lot of the pieces on this Monocle album are sort of dealing with this idea of like the internal becoming external. So there's some songs that are very personal that are then creating these large kind of external spaces. So, and then there's this kind of idea of like vulnerability versus bureaucracy that I find quite interesting. And so I think thematically it was sort of trying to walk this tightrope or explore these transformations between vulnerability and internalness and bureaucracy and what that creates, those layers that it creates. So it was a song sort of created by that.
Great that you got invited to participate in something like that. That must have been really eye-opening.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I mean, I was just a fly on the wall. It was kind of by chance that I was invited. The man that organizes it is a really fascinating man, and he had an idea that he wanted there to be live music, so I was there with a pianist, and he had this idea he wanted there to be live music that was played every hour and a half, and we would play for about 10 minutes, and his whole idea was that live music would kind of clear the brain of like intentionally focusing and listening to live music. So I don't even think he like cared that much about what kind of music. He just was sort of like, I will have live music every hour and a half to kind of clear the brain, have it cleared, you know. So it wasn't from my own personal, like, oh, I'm very internet savvy or technology savvy at all. I was sort of very happily, by happenstance, sort of got to be a fly on the wall and listen to these sessions and these conversations that were being had.
Great. I'm glad I asked.
Yeah.
That was a mysterious song to me. Now I get it. Arcade Lights. Very, almost nursery rhyme in its simplicity, melodically. Beautiful, like everything on this album. Inscrutable, at least for me. anything that you have to say about that, about the lyrics in this? Very interesting.
Gosh, see, you have looked at the lyrics way more often.
Oh, this is unfair. Unfair. Starts out three little birds.
I think of it as like it's sort of a children's story or an allegory that's about not putting people on pedestals. I think there was a period in sort of like artistic growth where it's like I respect this person so much and I want to be this person, or I want to try to become this artist, or I want to become this artist. And then there's a period in your life where you realize, like, I can't actually be anyone other than myself. And so, you know, I think there comes a time where you have to be like, no more gods. There's no more gods. There's no more people on pedestals that I'm trying to become. And so I think this song a little bit is sort of thinking about, like, giving the sort of childhood allegory about these three little birdies. This kind of wrathful, arrogant god that is, you know, even when these just simpleton birdies are trying to save an angel from falling, the god still strikes them down because they're disobeying his words. But I don't know. That's all in there. I don't know. It's whatever you see.
No, I get it. I get it. All right. I'm gonna do one more.
Okay.
Let's see. This is my chance. This is my chance to get all the answers to the mysteries. Well, breathing. I get it. Well, let this be a bonus one, and then I still want to do another one.
Okay.
Breathing boxes. Wow. That's kind of amazing that song was written 4 years ago. I don't know if you've thought about it since. Maybe not.
Yeah, I have thought about it since, but mostly because I've been doing these large projects with this music, you know, doing this large staged production with the music. So I've thought about it because of that.
No, what I mean is we've just gone through a year where literally breathing boxes were on the center stage.
That I know.
So,
yeah.
I mean, sometimes art, you know, anticipates reality, you know.
Yeah. That I have not thought about.
There's somewhere, I can't find the song. The one where you're talking about our city can't get a break.
Uh-huh.
Which song is that?
I think it's Big City Can't. That's Look Look.
Oh, Look Look. Okay. That's another, and for everybody, we're going to play some of these, maybe segments of some of them, so you get a sense of the melodies. These are just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful melodies.
Thank you.
And the fact that it's one artist doing all the instrumentation, and the fact that the arrangements are so interesting and the harmonies are so interesting, I mean, all that's there, and the poetry is so interesting. But the melodies, that's why I liken this to opera, because, you know, there's so much going on in opera, but ultimately it's those melodies that you just love them, you know?
Yeah, thank
you. I imagine Look Look is about, it's got to be about New Orleans, right?
Yeah. I sometimes say this is my, do you know what it means to miss New Orleans? This is my version of do you know what it means to miss New Orleans a little bit.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So yeah, it's again kind of dealing with bureaucracy and thinking about the people that actually live here and make New Orleans, New Orleans, and don't just use it as a playground. It's, you know, New Orleans is like a beautifully wonderful and vibrant place, and also has rampant disparity in wealth and a pretty corrupt political system.
Epic.
Environmentally, there's a lot of things that are endangering New Orleans, and those things are mostly human-made. So I think Look Look was really about, for me, really looking at New Orleans, and I think what the first line is, she got a mouthful of cellophane, he got lips made of fishing lines. It's kind of addressing all of the pollution and the disappearing of the Gulf South and the pollution that has sort of come into the everyday mechanisms of New Orleans and Louisiana, Southeast Louisiana at large, of having this really tragic dichotomy of being run by the oil industry and also being supported by the oil industry. So, you know, unfortunately, the oil industry is destroying a lot of the Southeast Louisiana, a lot of the way, the old ways of life of how people have been able to operate here. So, but it's also, it employs a lot of people in Southeast Louisiana. So that's what this song kind of came from.
Gotcha.
Again,
this is
looking
another...
at the bureaucracy of the leadership taking care of like big money rather than individuals, people who actually live in the city and make the city what it is.
Yeah, it makes even more sense to hear you describe it. Great line here. She twisted like a government. Clean, sterile sentences washed down with a peppermint. That's probably the best summary of government that I have ever heard. And then, you know, there's these choruses, you call it a chorus or choir or no, a chorus.
Yeah, a chorus.
Organize a mass depression, progress made, a fast impression, pressure drops and power wanes, alternate the current chains. And there's more, so everybody should. And is that this chorus is very applicable right this minute. And the track on the album is Look, Look. You know, you were talking about New Orleans. That might be a place for us to wrap up. I had a really nice conversation with Roger Lewis of
Dirty Dozen.
Brass Band. And what I'd like
amazing.
To talk with Yeah, oh my God, yeah. And what I wanted to talk with him about and something that he wanted to talk about was what the culture was like when he was growing up, you know, and the fact that, you know, it was different time, but that there were, apparently the Lower Nine was chock full of clubs. You know, everywhere you went, in people's backyards, you know, it was unbelievable. That's an Ornette Coleman story, by the way, just as a sidebar. I don't know if you knew, he got stranded on the road, and the Lasky family, which were musicians, Melvin, who died kind of young, was a really great trumpet player, and his dad was a drummer. You may know all this. They're related to the Andrews family.
I don't know any of
this. Oh, you don't know this? Oh, it's really interesting. Yeah. There was this really huge spiritualist religion downloading, you know, just like this huge, you know. And there was this one woman, and I can't remember her name exactly, but off the top of my head, but she was extremely powerful and had a lot of following. It was a very positive thing. It was a very, very, very positive thing. And when she passed it on to Melvin Lasky's dad, who was a drummer. And everybody was like, why are you passing this on to this drummer guy, you know? So in addition to being a musical family, they were very strong in the spiritualist church. So somehow Ornette and Melvin met each other when they were young, like Ornette was 19.
Wow.
And he was playing the medicine shows. You know, they still had traveling shows, you know.
Yeah.
This was 49, you know, so you didn't have the interstate highway. There's a whole bunch of stuff you just didn't have. You didn't have television. So it was just a different entertainment climate, and people that lived in the countryside were really in the countryside. They weren't getting much entertainment. So there was a lot of traveling shows. So I think he and Ornette were on a show together, and they got stranded, and he brought Ornette back to the Lower Nine. And so Ornette spent quite a bit of time, like months, living in New Orleans has so much history. Like, people don't even realize that Lester Young grew up in New Orleans as a child.
And
you know, it's like that obviously, and even in his bios when he talks, he's always talking about, I used to chase after the bands and I would listen. And it's like that had to have an impact on his aesthetic.
Right.
So what Ornette told me, and I actually have this on video, is that it was playing. He was, you know, because the Laskys were church people, he was always invited to come and play in, you know, because it was a very musically oriented church, to play. And he said, I have it in his own words, that it was through that experience that he really learned that he could play the way he wanted to play at fully.
Wow.
And, and, and do it. So that happened
amazing.
In New Orleans. Yeah, yeah.
Wow, you know, I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Few people do. And, you know, even people like Ray Charles, there was the Ray Charles before he hung out in New Orleans for months on end, and then the Ray Charles after he did. And I think a lot of musicians have had great transformative experiences in New Orleans. And,
yeah.
Right? And I'm a person that never – I passed through New Orleans once in 1990. I was driving from New York to San Francisco, and we just spent a night. And I mean, we were so clueless. We stayed in this, which I realize now is probably a crack hotel on Canal Street. I realize that now, like in retrospect. And then we went and walked along the street in French Quarter during the day, and like it was must have been the middle of winter. Nothing was going on, and I got the mistaken impression that New Orleans didn't have any music anymore.
Right? Wow! Crazy. No, everything I've heard about the New Orleans in the 90s is just pretty incredible. I mean, New Orleans in the 50s and 60s and 70s also, but, you know, a lot of the older musicians, the musicians that are a generation older than I, really came up in the 90s playing a lot of music. And it's, I feel like nostalgic. Having not been here, I feel nostalgic when I hear their stories of the clubs and the variety of music that was here. And kind of, you know, as Mr. Lewis was probably saying, like just tiny neighborhood clubs. It was all about like neighborhood clubs and local clubs and second lines, and then also like people writing original music and modern jazz being supported in the city at that time, which I feel like it is not as much, and original music and such a variety of different influences happening. So
yeah,
I'm sure there was stuff going on here when you passed.
Oh, I know.
I probably
walking on Bourbon Street at 1 o'clock in the afternoon in February or January.
Right.
No, you know what it was? It was late December. And I remember because we were going across the country. No, you know what? It was super early January. It must've been like January 2nd at 2 PM. That's probably the worst time.
Wow.
Arriving and try to find.
Yeah, that's hilarious. Pretty hilarious.
But anyway, what is great is when I finally came back and spent time, and then I discovered it, it was so amazing to realize what a deep thing is. So I always tell people who love music that if you've never been to New Orleans, you really have to go and spend as much time as you possibly can there, because it's like an onion. You know, you peel one layer away and you think, okay, that's it. And then you realize, oh no, there's this other layer. And then you peel that away and then there's another layer. And finally, you really do get to a point where you realize there is no end to this. This just keeps going.
That's right.
Right?
And it makes you cry, you know? Just like an onion. Yeah, eventually it'll make you cry. Just like, yeah.
Exactly. I've had some good crying jacks in New Orleans, too. And, believe me, it's a different place. It's not Kansas, and it's not
for
even
sure.
New York.
Yeah.
And I would actually caution people, too, take your time when you first get here. Seriously, don't think you can just dive in. Just take your time and get a sense of where you are, because it's not like any other place. You've been pretty much.
Yeah.
But on the musical side, what I'd like you to talk about, if you would, and we'll make this our last topic so you can go.
Okay.
Is I when I describe New Orleans to people, I go, well, it's like an open air 24/7 music conservatory of the highest quality. that's how I think of New Orleans. What's it like for you? Like, you arrived as a young musician. And you had, I'd love the story, you were bicycling all over the country, I guess, looking for interesting places, and you found New Orleans, and then you decided to settle. So there was a transition of Aurora Nealon having just arrived on by bicycle, and then Aurora Nealon gigging and, you know, being part of the scene. The thing that makes the scene is that there's a transition possibility for people that arrive. So maybe
sure,
you can talk about that.
Yeah. About how New Orleans,
how you found your way once you made the decision, hey, I'm gonna stay here a spell.
Sure.
And then, you know, because there may be some young musicians right now listening who are living in New Jersey or something, and it's not happening. No, nothing against New Jersey. I'm from that part of the world, and I grew up in New York City. Bronx. And if you want to talk about scenes, I was a teenager in the 70s in New York City. I mean,
oh, wow.
Nothing.
That's quite a nothing. Scene.
I mean, it was so amazing for, like, CBGB's was just a place. Like, it wasn't, we never thought of it as some, like, epic thing. You know, it was just a dump.
Cultural destination. Right.
Yeah. There was a club that people don't talk about much, but The Bottom Line, which was a really small music venue that had,
right.
I mean, everybody played there. Bruce Springsteen played there. One of the best things I ever saw musically in my life was Stanley Clarke, the bass player, did a gig there. I tapped my foot so hard. I honestly still get spasms in my calf, you know, 40 years later
wow.
from it.
That's amazing.
It was an amazing show, right? So that, and that was a small venue. That was, it was like a big, big living room. It was, but it was not, anyway, there was a lot of that stuff going on. So,
wow.
But not every scene in the world is like that. So there's a lot of places in the world where there is good music and good musicians and good stuff happening. But there ain't no place like New Orleans. So maybe you could explain that from the point of view of a young musician arriving and then finding your way and how New Orleans opened up to you, or you opened it
sure.
up, or however it happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think your story is the glossier one. I think your story paints it as much more intentional. I moved to New Orleans. I had one friend that was living down here, and I bicycled across the country. I was doing this project where I was collecting interviews and doing get out the vote work with a friend of mine. And I had one friend that was living down here, and so she said the rent is very cheap, and there's pianos everywhere. Come. She's a friend of mine from college who I'm still dear friends with. And so I came down here. I had a little Honda Civic that I drove down that had been parked in St. Louis. And so I biked to St. Louis and then got in this little Honda Civic with a bunch of everything that I owned and drove down and thought I would just stay for a couple months while I got together like a composition portfolio to apply for graduate school. And I was going to live with my friend Sarah and drove down. And when I got to New Orleans, my friend Sarah said, I have to leave. She had had a really bad breakup with a man, and it was pretty volatile. So she left, and then I was like, I'm in this new town. I don't know anyone. And I found a spot to live on Craigslist and started working at a coffee shop and was working on some compositions and then got into a graduate school program and decided to go for the next fall and then tried to move, planning to go to graduate school at UT Austin, and then Hurricane Katrina hit. And I ended up going to the graduate school for about 3 weeks. And in that time there, in those 3 weeks, I had really, before I left New Orleans, I had started playing a little bit out on the street and kind of just seeing images of Katrina and the devastation that was happening with the government and the bureaucracy, and being in a kind of a quite sterile environment of academia, I kind of quickly after 3 weeks was decided that I don't want to be here. I don't want to be in academia right now writing music that feels like it's just for academics. I don't want to be in a place where music is really meant for the community and meant for the fabric of the society that it exists in. And so I moved back to New Orleans and then began playing out on the street, and of course would go and see, at that time I would go and see the original Jazz Vipers a lot, who also played down at Spotted Cat or down at the Abbey even, Hot Club of New Orleans, and I would go see Hot 8 Brass Band and Soul Rebels when they played at the Bon Ton. And yeah, there was just a lot of incredible community music making. The function of music in New Orleans is to interact with the people that live here. And, you know, it's sort of a byproduct that it gets commodified and sold to tourists. But the really beautiful thing that I think you feel here if you come down even as a visitor is that this is music that's actually meant for the community of people that live here. And the rituals and the celebrations that are deeply rooted in the fabric of this place. So I was really fortunate to sort of be under the wing of some older musicians when I got here. Sydney Snow, one of them, a bass player, and some of the folks at Preservation Hall, and to start learning some of this music.
So that was kind of how I came to New Orleans. I have definitely moved away or tried to move away many times. The first time I tried to move away or was planning on moving away back to the West Coast, I hit by a drunk driver the night before I was going to move. And so it bashed up, you know, my car was undrivable and I bashed up my knees. So I couldn't like walk very well. And that was the first time I tried to move away. And so I think the third time I tried to move away, there was another sort of like these sort of karmic things that kept happening. And I would say since the time, now I've been here 16 years, and in that time I've definitely have had many periods where it's like, I'm moving, I'm leaving, I'm going somewhere different. And sometimes I'll go somewhere different for eight months and think that it's going to be forever. And sometimes I'll go somewhere different for 2 months. And yeah, but I think I've finally come around to accepting and also feeling honored to realize like this is the place where I have spent the most time, and I've really like been very fortunate to build roots here. And so I'm really trying to honor and accept that and not always think about running away anymore, but rather like I would like to be able to use this as like the basis, and this is my home and this is where my heart is. And so that's that story. I think New Orleans can provide many amazing, beautiful things. And I also think it's important to have other perspectives, and because it can also be a tiny bubble, you know. So as with almost sure. anything in life, it is all of the things, good and bad, encompassed.
Yeah, I mean, choose your bubbles wisely, you know?
Yes, choose your bubbles wisely.
And it's a pretty good bubble as bubbles go, actually.
It is.
And I you know, I always encourage people who love music, try to, you know, if you've never been, try to get down and give yourself some time and do a little homework, you know, so you know. You can do a lot of research online about which clubs are happening and where to go, and just plan to see more live music than you've probably ever seen outside of a festival. Right?
Yeah,
it's just,
that's true.
You know?
Yes,
and
that is true.
It's just a wonderful thing. So for people that want to follow Aurora and what she's up to, which is not always easy. She only likes to publish the big things. But you can still get on her mailing list. So if you go to Aurora Nealon, and I'll have that link there, at the bottom left-hand list, bottom left-hand side of the website, it says contact. There's booking info. And then there's a button that says mailing list sign up. So you can sign up for her email list, which I strongly encourage if you're interested in what you've heard. And then you have a Facebook page. Is that active? You do anything with that?
Yeah, it's active-ish, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So if you're a Facebook person, that's definitely a way to engage as well. You might get more information from the Facebook page than the email list, but it's good to be on Aurora's email list. I strongly encourage it.
Yeah, thank you.
Now to get this music, if you're a digital music person, which I am not, I still like physical media, but I know a lot of people are digital music people. You can go to, I'll put the link below, but I believe it's auroranealand.bandcamp.com. And everybody that knows what Bandcamp is knows all about that. So the album that we've been talking about on this call, plus her other stuff, is all available through Bandcamp. And if you like trad jazz stuff, you're going to love the Royal Roses. You're going to just love that group. Now, there's another way to get physical stuff, which is through the Louisiana Music Factory, and that's a great institution in New Orleans, a record store,
yeah.
And they have a website that's very well organized, and if you go to the Louisiana Music Factory and search around using Aurora Nealand as the search term, you're certain to find physical artifacts,
yeah.
Right? So that's that.
Yeah, and that's a great way to really support Louisiana Music Factory also. They're a great local business who has done a lot for all the local artists here. So it's always nice to send them business.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I always encourage people when they're at live events and the musicians are selling CDs, you know, if you have the money, buy the CD, right? It's not that much.
Yeah.
And then you can keep learning their music, and then they don't have to, that's one less CD they have to carry home.
Yeah.
And right? And
that's important.
But It really is. And it's a big deal, by the way. It's a big deal to buy CDs. And I also encourage people, like, it's Christmas. We're recording this before Christmas, so you're probably going to hear this after Christmas. So, but Christmas comes around every year. There are birthday parties. There are all kinds of gift-giving opportunities, and I really think music is a great, great gift to give. And it sort of serves multiple purposes. Number one, your friend will be delighted to get great music. And number two, you're supporting music. And the making and selling of CDs is a important line of income for a lot of musicians. So buying CDs is always a good thing. And then buying them through the Louisiana Music Factory is great. If you don't know the Louisiana Music Factory, wow, you'll be amazed. And you know, we all underestimate how much New Orleans has contributed to American music. And once you start, you know, it's that onion thing again. Once you start pulling the layers back, you'll just discover more and more and more music. And fortunately for all of us, Louisiana Music Festival has got everything. Deep as you can go, they can go with you.
Yeah.
Well, Aurora, thank you so much. This has been something I've been wanting to do for a long, long time, and we've done it. And wish you well. And if there's anything
you want
to... Thank you so much, Ken.
Thank you for all your support and enthusiasm. It's so great to have folks that are genuinely invested and curious and active listeners. You know, the making music is only half of what happens when you make music, so it's really important to have the active listener on the other end.
Well, we have great fans at Jazz on the Tube. They love the music, and they're also really curious about the history, and more and more I'm introducing stuff about the theory, you know, so that we can all understand what a sixth and a fifth is, and what a 1/5 were. You know, it's not that hard, you know, and it's good to have filed away back there. I always say, like, if you're going out to eat and you know, well, who grew the tomatoes and who grew the okra and whose grandmother showed who how to cook them and how did they do it? When you know all that, the food is even better, you know?
Right. Yes, that is true.
Yeah, so that's what our podcast series is about, is to try to get into what's going on in the kitchen, basically.
That's good.
So great, Aurora. And I have an address for you. I imagine it has not changed, right?
It has not,
Okay, great.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to remind you about some names that you're going to send me.
Yes.
I might remind you in a couple of days. And then we'll send you a bunch of stuff. Well, Aurora Neeland, thank you very much. Everybody go to Aurora Neeland. That's A-U-R-O-R-A.
O-R-A.
N-E-A. land.com. That's the website, and that's how you can access her mailing list, the Facebook group, all at the bottom. You can listen to some of her music. You can go to Bandcamp, and if you're a digital person, get the music there, or you can go to New Orleans Music, Louisiana Music Factory, and get the physical stuff. So this is Ken McCarthy saying goodbye to everybody, and I'll catch you next time.
Thank you, Ken.